Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to this new session. We're going to be talking about egoism today. So before we start, inshallah, let's hear the poem being read in Arabic and then we'll come back and speak about it.
فصل الأنانية أما الأناني فهو ما اعتقد أن السرور والسعادة مرد للذات لكن السوى يساعد بنسبة وكل ذا مباعد عن الصواب إذ يجيء دور يفسد ما عن مثل ذا يثور فإن بكرا قد يكون فرحا وغيره إذا رآه ترحا.
So I want to ask you a question just to get started. Let's keep this interactive. We'll start with this question, and at home you're going to be thinking about this question as well. This is actually, I'm going to give you a quote from David Hume. He says, if you ask a man why he hates pain, he cannot answer. Okay, meaning this is inexplicable, this is the base, this is so self-evident that it does not require elaboration. To what extent do you agree with this? Speak to the person next to you, you think about it at home. We'll come back and speak about it. Go ahead. All right, guys, let's get some contributions. Mahdi, actually, let's start with you two. You were talking...
So David Hume is saying that if he was to ask a person why he hates pain, he cannot answer.
Yeah.
I would disagree with this because a person would be able to answer by saying that the reason I hate pain is because my body is made this way, because of my biological makeup, because I have neurons which fire based on these, you know...
He wouldn't disagree with all that.
Yeah.
That's not his point here. He's saying that ask a child. Let's put it in that language, right? If you know, get a 1-year-old and prick the 1-year-old and see what the 1-year-old does. What do you think the 1-year-old is going to do? Start crying, right?
Yeah.
So is that an expression of satisfaction or dissatisfaction?
Yeah,
when someone cries, right?
Yeah,
so it's as good as them saying, I don't like this, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So can they tell you the neurons and all that kind of stuff?
No, but they would say something like, this doesn't feel good, right?
So this why
this is the answer.
Why do you not like it?
Yeah, so he would say, because it doesn't feel good, but at least he's answering the question, right?
See, this is the point he's making, that it's inexplicable, it's self-evident.
Is it only circular, then? Like,
no, go ahead. You're on the right tracks. It's good. You're trying to be skeptical, but this is a very difficult one to be skeptical about, right? Go ahead.
I'm not sure. I was just gonna say, can you only argue from like a circular kind of point? I don't like it because I don't like it.
This is not morality. He's not saying it's not good because it's the way you are.
Okay.
He's just saying you don't like it. You don't feel. You don't.
I'm saying yeah.
How about? Do you have anything to say?
It's not inherently pleasing. It's just completely opposite to our...
goes against like the fifth row.
Yeah, there you have it, right?
Yeah.
Right, okay, so it's against an inclination that we have.
Yeah.
It's we don't even require justification for it. If I put a candle on this table and I put my hand on it, I don't need to philosophize why I don't want to put my hand on the candle. It's instinctual.
Mm-hmm. Would you say it's a priori?
No, because it's not rational. Remember, we differentiated in the epistemology lesson between what's instinct and what's rationalizable.
Okay.
This actually does go back to the epistemology thing. Any points here?
We just said that pain in itself, nobody likes it, and we agree with the premise.
Yeah, I find it hard. When I read it the first time around, I wasn't going to attack it too much because I thought, this is true, like, you know, baseline pain and pleasure is practically out. You can make a very strong argument, intuitive or at least instinctual. You can make this argument.
But you could say that the assumption sometimes is not right, because sometimes it does.
Yeah. There's no assumption here. Like, it's not an argument being made, right? We're saying that we have to differentiate between two things, and we're gonna do so more so in this lesson. Yeah, we have to differentiate between psychological makeup and ethical standards. So remember, how do we get from psychological to ethical? How do we get from is to ought? How do we do that?
It needs to be objective morality.
Yeah. How do we do that?
A doctrine.
You give value to something, and you justify why
Okay, let me rephrase the question. How do you identify a moral claim? How do you know if someone's making a moral claim?
If there's a should in there.
If there's a should in there.
Yeah.
Or shouldn't. Right, wrong.
Yeah.
If these keywords are not there, it's not a moral claim. We have to be careful because we could be attacking something which doesn't require attack. Mm. You know? You can't say, well, you're making an assumption when the person's not even making an argument. In ethics, you only start making an argument when you start using terms of moralizing terms. This is very important. You know, if you don't know this, put this down somewhere. And what are the key terms that we're talking about? Right, wrong, is. Oh, yeah, sorry, not is. Right, wrong, should, shouldn't, ought, oughtn't, yeah? You should do this, you shouldn't do that. Now you're telling me what I should do. Now you're moralizing, okay? But if I say to you, you are like this, you are not like this, I'm not moralizing.
Yeah.
I'm telling you what you're about. All right, on that point, and this is an important segue.
Let's have a quick
question. Yes.
Just brainstorming, but like, what if you're to ask a man, like, why he loves pain? So, for example, there are some people who actually love pain, right? Like, is that
pain anymore, is it?
Yeah.
Look, that then he's asked the right question.
Yeah.
He's asked the right question. If you love it, then does it become pain? Because you've now used the term that indicates your affinity towards it. If you use the word love, that's it. It's no longer a pure pain.
Mm.
We're talking about pain in its purity, where there is no enjoyment or anything like that. A sadistic person or a masochist or I don't know, these kinds of things, they don't apply here because they enjoy it somehow. There's some people sexually, they like these kinds of pains and these kinds of things. You laugh at it. No, but it's not, clearly, that's not, you know. People go to the gym because, and there's pain involved in that. Almost every sport has pain involved in it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's that we mean a pure pain with no benefit, no enjoyment, no sense of achievement, you know. Going on to this, the difference between psychological egoism and ethical egoism. So, okay, egoism is the idea of self-interest, self-love, okay? Self-interest, selfishness, okay? Self-love, yeah? Now, psychological egoism is the idea that we, as human beings, are self-interested by nature. That everything that we do is for ourselves. Every single thing you do is for yourself. Is this a moral claim?
No.
It's not a moral claim because we're not saying it should be, ought to be, it's okay for it to be, it's good for it to be for yourself. But that's why it's called psychological egoism. Psychologists speak about it. It's the field now of psychology. So everything you do is for yourself. This is a very important question. I'm going to pause here and I want you to really think about this. To what extent do you agree with this statement? 3 minutes, speak to the person next to you. Really think about it.
Obviously,
all right, so yeah, let's get back and there's some interesting conversations going on here. Why don't you bring it to us? Tell us what you're talking about.
Yeah, so we mentioned that there is definitely truth in this. In that a person, usually, you know, when they live their daily life, they do things out of self-interest, you know, whether it be work and so on. And also out of self-love. And the reason a person does something is usually to fulfill like a kind of a satisfaction within themselves, whether it's like mental, biological, and the financial, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then we kind of progress on, so we go, okay, how about a mother who loves her child? You know, usually a mother would sacrifice her own interests, her own well-being for the sake of her child. But then a person might be able to argue and say that a mother is only doing this to fulfill her own biological needs, her own instinctual needs, right? However, is this the same as her sacrificing herself from a psychological standpoint? Like, because psychologically, her interest would still be to, you know, like, I don't know, to eat this plate of food rather than give it to her child. So it's like there's a confliction of like biological need and her like psychological kind of interest there.
Yes, yeah, I think you're definitely thinking about it on the right tracks, and this is exactly the kind of conversations that I had. You know, on the example of the mother sacrificing herself for the child, It could very well be argued that she's doing that because she couldn't live with herself if she didn't do that. Mm-hmm. She'd rather live a life where she would rather not live than have to live a life thinking that she didn't save her child. So the pain of not sacrificing her child, herself for her child, would be more than the pleasure that she would have living the rest of her life in guilt.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the kinds of arguments, and you know,
so that would be the grenade example.
Pardon?
If there's a
grenade.
Yeah.
Yeah, the grenade example is actually one that's sort of used as well, like mm-hmm. you know, and you know, jumping on a grenade and stuff. But then, the question is that person doing it to leave some kind of a legacy behind?
Yeah.
Or because they think that this is what's going to really, like, the thought of them doing that will make them into some kind of a historical figure.
Or if they don't do it.
But if they don't do it, then they say, yeah, for example, the nation will be destroyed, his family will be raped, his house will be taken.
Or he's mentally not going to live.
Or mentally he can't live with the pain.
Yeah.
Or a combination of all of those factors.
Yeah.
So then he ultimately reasons, I'm going to jump on this grenade and be brave. And that makes me a man, or that makes me a patriot, or that makes me a true warrior or something. You know, any other points on this?
Basically, we agree with the other guys. There's always a degree of self-interest, whether that's an internal happiness that you gain from something, or you can gain the exterior adulation of other people by doing something.
Yeah.
So there's always some form of self-interest involved.
Do you know, it's very good, well put. I think that's absolutely, I think it's very difficult to argue against this. Basically, I think it has been very difficult for anyone to argue against in psychology and even in philosophy to a lesser extent. But what I find interesting is there's been a proliferation recently in the last, I would say, 20 or 30 years, especially, of literature and psychology about narcissism. I'm not sure if you've seen this. There's even YouTube channels being established, how to deal with a narcissist and how to do this and that.
Yeah.
Everyone thinks everyone else is the narcissist, but everyone has the narcissist in them, you know? And the conventional model, right, is you've got a spectrum. I'm not sure if you've seen the spectrum or if you've heard of it, but you've got, on the one side, you've got the overt narcissist. And then on the other side, you have what you call the covert narcissist. And these are two sides of, it's like a spectrum, right? So the overt narcissist is an exhibitionist. Comes across as extremely confident. Basically like me. You know, they will openly tell you what they want in life, and they're very disagreeable, these kind of things. That one is easy to identify, but the covert narcissist, they're more difficult to identify because they can be introverted. They're introverted. In relationship psychology, by the way, a lot of the times, for better or worse, it's attributed to the woman in the relationship. So the man, he's trying to dominate his partner through overt means, you know, trying to shout at her, talk to her, threaten, whatever. The woman, what she'll do, you know, this is a simplistic model of, you know, covert narcissism. And what she will do a lot of the time, she'll, okay, stay quiet, whatever. And then she will leverage the man in a way which is more subtle. Mm. She'll go speak to her friends about him. She'll make a plan with her mum about the guy. And so, and these kinds of things, it's like, obviously this is very simplistic, but all of them are doing the same thing, which is what? They're all trying to fulfill their own interest. And they're using whatever is in their power to be able to do so. Why wouldn't the woman in the relationship, conventionally, right? Why wouldn't she use overt means? Because she has a lacking of advantage in that aspect. She's not going to go over-dominate the guy that's bigger and stronger than, louder than her, has more money than her, as in most cases, or whatever it is, yeah? So she'll use the hidden, you know, the model goes in. This is, you know, how they talk about it. Means. And then you have the narc mum. Have you heard of this? The narc mum. A narcissistic mum. And you have all these terms about different types of narcissists. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got this one and that one. And these. The point of the matter is, the assumption is always that we are free from this ability or this propensity to be egoistic and self-interested. And everyone else is doing it to us. And it's true that someone can be so pathological or neurotic, yeah? That they seem not to care at all about, and this is probably what they're referring to when they're talking about narcissism. But the question is, who really gets to set the criterion? Where does it become narcissism? Where does it stop being psychological egoism and start being psychological narcissism? This is a subjective criterion. Let's just completely be honest about it. And who gets to judge it? And who will be discriminated against the most in these analyses? Mostly, I would wager it would be the overt narcissist, because it's so obvious that they're what they're trying to do. The covert narcissist gets, soft voice, calm, this and that. But she's a monster. He's a monster, right? Yeah, she's been trying to do it behind his back. She's still talking to her girlfriends about him. Maybe she's cheating on him, You know what I mean? Maybe she's doing all this kind of... Maybe she's taking stealing his mind. Whatever it may be. But these are just hidden... But it's the same, thing. So, these are just interesting side notes. I'm not convinced, I have to say, looking at the literature of in psychology on narcissism. There's lots of books that are popular books and academic works. I'm not convinced that this thing is a hard and fast science. I'm not convinced at all by that. And they refer to it really as a personality disorder. But who gets to really choose, okay, this person has a psychological disorder and who's that? And the one who gets to choose that is actually in an authoritative position, by the way. You're giving that person a lot of power by choosing who is the bad guy and who's the good guy in this equation. And I think these are conversations that we need to start having, because if it's true, and I think we all have identified, that we've all got some kind of psychological propensity to self-interest, even the most seemingly giving person that you've ever seen in your life, then the labeling of narcissist, not narcissist, and this kind of language, that can be very damaging. It's like, Islamic heresiology. This guy's a kafir, this guy's a mubtada. Who gets to choose? Who gets to choose? You know, it's the same thing. The psychologist can use this to blackmail, to harm somebody. Oh, he's a narcissist. We have to deal with him in that way. Or this person's that way. You have to do that. So we have to be careful of these kinds of things, especially in pastoral settings. Yeah. Now that we know the underpinning psychology behind it, we'll take all of their descriptions with a very heavy pinch of salt. Okay. We have to take it with a very heavy pinch of salt, because otherwise people can be abused in the community, being labeled and otherwise. Anyway, this is just a side point. The point of the matter is, I think we all agree that the human action is largely motivated by self-interest. Okay. Now, ethical egoism, on the other hand, okay, ethical egoism is the idea that you should act within your best interest. That you should act. Now we're moving away from is to ought. Okay, no, it's not just that you are acting within your best interest. You should. Why should you? Because you live one time, according to the secular ethic. You only live once. This is your pleasure. Why should you sacrifice your happiness and enjoyment for somebody else? Why should you sacrifice? Why should you have this slave mentality of serving? And maybe these people won't even be grateful for what you have to do. So it's not even, there's no reciprocity there. Maybe there's no transaction. There's no transaction there. There's no interaction. There's no, you're being abused, basically. This is the idea. Of course, we're going to talk about this in more detail in the coming slides. This is actually closely linked to the idea of the id ego and the superego. And I think it's an important thing. We've talked about the id ego and the superego. This is a very important thing in psychology, right? And it's called psychoanalysis, yeah? So the branch of psychology which refers to the unconscious mind with thinkers such as Freud and Carl Jung. These are probably the two most prominent ones in the early 20th century who spoke about these things. Jung had this idea of the self, or the psyche, he referred to as the psyche. And Freud, very famously, he divided the human unconscious drivers into id, ego, and superego. Id, okay, you're born, according to Freud, you're born an id. Now, what is an id? You're born, all you have is wants and desires. Like, if many of you have had children, many of you have seen little children walking around. I want this, I don't want this, I hate this. That's how they are. They don't have a filter. So they don't think about it. They just, that's what I want. Cry, that's how you get. We're all born with just once, basically. And the ego is societal rules. So when you get older, do this, don't do this. You get older, like 6 years old, 5 year old, 3 year old, even three. You have to go to the toilet now, potty training, this, that, whatever it may be, yeah? And then when you grow older, you have more and more rules imposed upon you. And then this thing called the superego sorts it out. So the superego says, this is when you can have fun, and this is what, or you can indulge in whatever desire you have, and this is when you can't. So this is the Freudian model, the ego and the superego. And this is important because obviously the assumption is that you do have these drivers, that you do have these wants and desires, yeah? But that you're trying to moderate them so you can survive, basically, in the society that you live in and stuff. Okay, so it's closely connected to that as well. And by the way, this is very important, actually. I think we should mention it. Counseling and psychological services, we might as well mention this, right? For example, in this country, you have two major kind of things. If someone has mental health issues, obviously they'll give them drugs. SSRIs, they're called serotonin something, inhibit something, I don't remember the acronym. You know, citalopram, these kinds of things. You take it and it's meant to increase your serotonin. Yeah, this is one model. But they also have counseling. And counseling is divided into two. You have psychoanalysis, and then you have CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. And they both operate on different paradigms. And the psychoanalysis operates on the paradigm that you, when growing older, you had these psychosexual stages of development. You had these wants, these desires, whatever. And your pathologies and your problems in life, your mental issues, relate to your upbringing. For the most part, this is simplistic, but yeah, that's a big chunk of it. So if you're, what the therapist will do with you, if they've been trained, they'll sit with you, if it's psychoanalysis, they call it the talking cure. They'll get you to talk. So what this, ask some questions. You'll end up talking 80% of the time. You'll think, this person's wasting my time because I'm just telling them my story. I'm not saying this is ineffectual, by the way. I'm just saying this is what happens, yeah? And then they'll start asking you questions about your childhood. What did your dad do when you answered that? You know, how about your mum? Relationship with your parents, or whatever. You know, and then there's a breakthrough moment. Maybe when you were a 7-year-old, your mum slapped you or something in front of everyone. I don't know. Like, or maybe your dad wasn't giving you some good the affection that you needed, or you know, whatever it may be. And then they'll pinpoint. You know, this is usually what happens, right? And they'll pinpoint this time. And say, this is when everything changed for you, because it has to do with your wants and your desires, etc. And so the idea of psychoanalysis is predicated on these assumptions that we're talking about here. And they're all connected. It's all interconnected. Now, why am I mentioning this? It's because a lot of the time a counselor will come and say to you, you need to have more self-esteem. They'll use this exact terminology, self-esteem. Now, what is self-esteem? Self-esteem is actually the language that egoists use. Self-esteem is actually self-love. In fact, Ayn Rand, the philosopher who puts forward ethical egoism, she makes a point of making this term self-esteem, self-esteem. We need to boost your self-esteem, boost self-esteem, boost self-esteem. What is the opposite of self-esteem? Insecurity. The idea is that you shouldn't have insecurities, that you should have self-esteem, which means you should love yourself and be capable, you should be so confident in your own abilities. But the question is, why should we? Why should you even have it? Why should you be allowed self-esteem? I know it's maybe an uncomfortable question, but if you don't have self-esteem, maybe you shouldn't have it. Is there anything that suggests that you should have self-esteem, self-love? You should love yourself. Love yourself, they say. Have you seen this? You've seen this, right? They'll sit with you in, you know, it can be a gender-based thing. It can be a race-based thing. We have to love ourselves first. So about for us first. Why? Because if we don't love ourselves, no one's going to love us. Whatever, like, you know. But the idea is there. Like, this is egoism. Yeah. And what I'm saying is, it creeps away from psychological egoism and starts to make its way into ethical egoism through things even so subtle as counseling. You need to build your self-esteem. But wait a minute. If that person doesn't have self-esteem because they are being told off by someone in their life who's an authority figure, or someone who knows something about them that they potentially need to change, according to a reciprocal model of morality, then maybe self-esteem is not the best thing for them. Maybe they shouldn't have self. Maybe they should have insecurity. Maybe insecurity is the solution. Could you ever imagine a counselor saying to a, you should have a little bit more insecurity? Can you imagine that being said? It's not going to be said, because remember, you're trying to make that person feel better.
True, yeah.
Why are you trying to make him feel better? What's the assumption here? What about if he needs to feel worse?
There's the assumption that
do you see the point? True, yeah. Like, how about that? Like, you know, these are very deep questions. But what I'm saying is, ethical egoism creeps its way into a moral landscape through things like counselling sometimes, through things like conversations behind closed doors, locker room talk, whatever it may be. It creeps its way back into the discourse, and then you'll start to develop an entire morality which you don't even realise you have. I need to think about myself. Maybe you've said that to yourself one day. I know I have. You know, this was yesterday, I was thinking. I was thinking, you know, I was driving up here. You know, whatever, like, you know. I had to think about myself first as well. I had to think about myself, you know. And then they'll start justifying it. If I don't have the oxygen, you know, then I can't give it to anyone. You know, these kinds of examples. Yeah. And sometimes, I'm not saying these justifications are all wrong, by the way. I'm just saying, so far, we're now moving into ethics. And we have to be careful, because everything ethical now is the domain for us as Muslims of the divine. This is the domain of the divine. So we have to start. I don't know if you are following. Any questions on this point?
On Islamic paradigm, it's not necessarily wrong to think of yourself first, right?
Well, this is the next step, right? Yeah. Good. Islam has a diagnostic, okay? And this is the next slide. It has a diagnostic and it has a prescription, okay? The Islam diagnoses the human being as selfish and motivated by anxiety. It actually does that. It agrees with this to a large extent. You know, وَإِنْ أَذَقَنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَأُوسٌ كَفُورٌ. You know, when we have given the person mercy and then we take it away from him, he is ya'us, he's hopeless, and kafur, he's very ungrateful. You know, obviously in the yawma yafirru al-mar'u min akhi, on the day of judgment, this is most acutely felt. Everyone's going to be running away from their own family members. It's the same human being, right? You're going to be running away from your mum and dad. What kind of, you can't say I'm altruistic. You know, one of them was going to want to ransom their lives with their kids and this and that. When the stakes go higher, we become more selfish. Basically, that's the model in Islam. The stakes go higher, we become more and more selfish. We say, no, we're not going to take that pain. There's a point where the pain becomes too much that we don't even care about our parents and our own kids. That's the idea. This agrees with ethical egoism on a psychological level to a high extent, in my view, right? Because look at the verses. How could you explain that? That means that the assumption is people are self concerned.
Yeah.
They are.
Even the prophets.
Yeah, we won't go into this. You know, I know the hadith, nafsi, and myself.
The Quran,
yeah.
They still always make dua for themselves first, right? Rabbi najini wa ahli. They'll start with themselves first.
Yeah, we'll come to this, but you're on the right track, Sam, for sure. So this is a diagnostic. What does Islam say? Does it say you shouldn't think about yourself? It doesn't say that, by the way. Well, otherwise, Jannah and Nar would not be incentives. Heaven and Hell would not be incentives. If a lot of the incentives in the religion of Islam are based on the model that human beings are actually self-interested. You threaten them with more pain, because if you don't, then the more pain you threaten someone with, and the more they believe that that's actually a legitimate threat, the less likely they are to do the action. And this is, you could say this is behavioralist psychology 101 and what's in the skin and the dog and whatever. This is the truth.
We saw that now with the COVID.
Hmm?
We saw that with the COVID now.
Yeah, with COVID, but with, you know, if someone puts a gun to your head, you're going to change. Your whole demeanor is going to change.
My point is, it wasn't even that
deep. Yes. Exactly, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. Now, so Islam does. However, the Islamic model is, the purpose of life is to worship God. And worshipping God, the apex of it, is to worship God for what reason?
His pleasure.
Because he's worthy of worship. Not because... So, if you try and form an intent... Islam actually says, if you try and form an intention that says that I'm worshipping Allah, not because it's good for me, or because of heaven and hell, but because he's worthy of worship, that's a higher level intentionality than to do it for your own sake. Now, can someone... The question is, can someone completely... And I've thought about this a lot. Can someone completely break off any notion of self-interest from this? I think that's difficult. I would say for me, because I can't speak on anyone else about, that's impossible.
Ghazali talks about that in his literature, doesn't he? He said the highest form is do it for the pleasure of Allah. Like people, some people do it for the nar.
Yeah, exactly. Nar. So to do it for the pleasure of Allah, to do it because Allah is worthy of worship. Yeah.
Mm.
However, is that the only reason why I'm doing it? It's going to be difficult. I would never say yes to that question. That would be me lying to you in front of your faces. There's always an element of self-interest there.
Yeah.
In my opinion, for me anyway. My aim is not to try and deplete that, because I don't think Allah has held me to that standard. And if he held me to that standard, there would be no heaven and hell. Worship Allah, no incentive, no disincentive. He knows what he created.
Yeah.
And he created self-interested, to a large extent, beings. But we have to try and rid ourselves from this as much as we can.
Yeah.
We do actually have. And it's not inconceivable, the Islamic paradigm goes, for you to worship God because God is worthy of worship, because he has all these attributes, and that this is the most appropriate thing to do with a God like that, or the only God that's worthy of worship, which is Allah. Now, if you're worshipping Allah, like you're praying and you're fasting, and that's in your mind, that's the highest form of worship. That's actually the highest form of worship. Where you try and have an out-of-body experience, like you actually think to yourself, I'm doing this because God is worthy of worship. Even though the unconscious mind might say, you're a liar.
Yeah,
the unconscious mind will say to you, liar. You're doing this because you feel good, don't you? Huh? But let the unconscious mind say whatever it wants to say. So long as you make a conscientious effort to say that to yourself when you're praying, this is khushu' level, high level, which is like, you know, when you're concentrating in the prayer. It's the highest level. There's no higher. This is the spiritual apex.
Yeah.
Now, the second question is, because that's fine, that's a spiritual discussion. But now, let's talk about practical discussion. Yeah, if you want to, you can read this woman's book, you know, Ayn Rand. She has a book called Virtue of Selfishness. And she basically makes the argument that even despite the consequences, like, but this could justify genocide. These are some of the problems, right? If it's despite the consequences, no, it's no longer consequentialist, then you can kill somebody. I want to do it. So what? You're going to stop me? You can hurt somebody. You can do these things. And then we go back to kind of utilitarian logic, but even worse, because it's not even considering the whole good. It's even worse. Maybe I shouldn't use that unneutral term. Even more individualistic. Yeah, it's an individualistic form. So it's like utilitarianism, only that it does not care about the collective good. So it's egoism. These things are all connected. But it is tahqiq al-ayah, where Allah says, "Afara'aytum man ittakhadha ilahu hawa." Have you seen the one who has taken his own Lord as his own self as God? That's another. It's exactly the same thing now, just like individualism, as we're going to cover, just like liberalism is founded on that, and utilitarian. All of them are going back to the same thing. That somebody just wants. What we have to be weary of as Muslims is that we don't take ourselves as the Lord. By establishing that there's a higher authority that's worthy of worship, that's not us. And that we submit those desires, our desires, to that higher authority. Okay? So to summarize this point, okay? Psychological egoism, we said, is self-interest. Ethical egoism is that you should have self-interest. The Islamic model says you do have self-interest. Because يَوْمَ يَفِرُّ الْمَرْءُ مِنْ أَخِيهِ. You're going to be self-interested, yeah? However, And yes, that's natural. It doesn't, it's not aib, it's not bad in Islam for you to be self-interested. But the apex of spirituality in Islam is to worship Allah for what?
Worthy.
Because he's worthy of worship. Not because of? Not because it's for your own. Yeah. Now, when you're doing that, when you're praying now and you're doing dua and you're doing sujood and whatever, yeah? And you're thinking, I'm doing this because Allah, he's worthy of this. It's the most appropriate action. Is there a conflict of interest inside of your psyche, if you want to put it in Jungian terms, or your id ego and super ego, if you Freudian terms, or your nafs, if you want to put it in Islamic terms? Yes, there is a conflict of interest, because your nafs is saying no. Mm-hmm. Your nafs is saying, I'm doing this for my own sake. But despite the fact that your nafs will continue saying that, and if you're honest about it, you just verbalize it. I'm doing this for myself, yeah? You have to conscientiously make an effort to deplete that from your nafs. Now, you will never succeed. I know that sounds... it's impossible. I personally believe it's... I will never succeed. Let me speak about my own. I will never succeed in doing that. But the effort is all that is God wants to see from our perspective. That effort. You will never do anything outside of your interest. But the effort is that which brings you to the high level, the apex of spirituality. Now, we said egoism's problem is that it doesn't, if especially if you consider non-consequentialist types, doesn't consider the consequences. You can kill somebody, you can rape somebody, you can do. Also, it doesn't have any base. Like, if we're talking about the difference between us as Muslims and them as egoists, is that we say that we take the ultimate authority as Allah. They say we take the ultimate authority as us. And this is going to be linked to individualism. We know what's best for us. We say, no, we don't. We submit our will to that which knows what's best for us, which is Allah. That's the difference. That the issue of ultimate authority. We take as our ultimate authority Allah. They take as our ultimate authority themselves. And if we ask them, why should you take yourself as your Lord? They will have no answer for that. We know what's best for us. No, you don't. There's actually no evidence to show that you know what's best for you. Especially if considering the existence of an all-knowing entity. If you consider such existence, then that all-knowing entity knows more about you than you know about yourself. Individualism and egoism, a hidden assumption is that you know what's best for you. That is a baseless assumption, especially considering that there's an all-knowing entity out there. Yeah.
We are all egoists.
You can say we believe in a form of psychological egoism, yes, but not ethical egoism.
So we should be egoists based on what?
We're not. We shouldn't be egoists. Egoism. Remember, ethical egoism, yeah, is that we should be. We care about ourselves only. Yeah. We say no. We don't care about ourselves only because we think that the higher authority is Allah. So we're Muslims.
The point is, we are egoists.
Oh yeah. So we're psychologically,
yeah, psychologically
self-interested. Yeah, yeah.
So now, but it's still being based on what all the people say, based on what God says.
Yes.
That's something.
Yes. 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 Yes.
So what we're looking to gain is what differentiates, is what makes something morally justifiable or not. So, for example, we're trying to, if you're looking to gain the pleasure of God, that's morally justifiable. If you're looking to gain maybe like popularity, it's not justifiable. That's our pattern, right?
Let's get to that, right? You can gain popularity and you can have money and you can enjoy yourself within our paradigm.
Right, but that should be
because Allah knows what we're about. He's not telling us not to be what we are. Every monk, an ascetic and zahid that says I'm gonna divorce the dunya is a liar, and he's never been able to achieve that. And that's something that the Prophet has told us. We've seen this in hadith. You know, some monks say, I'm never going to get married. I'm going to keep fasting. You're just doing that in vain. Because it's like you're not nourishing. You're not being genuine and authentic to your true self. Your true self doesn't say that. You want a little bit of popularity, actually. You want a little bit of money, actually. You want a bit of sex and food. And there's nothing wrong with any of that. In fact, you should have a little bit more. No problem. So long as you do it within the paradigms of Islam. Allah is not bringing us, as making us X and telling us to be Y. It's like a transgender project. Like, you created me as a man, well, I'm going to be a woman now. There is a sense that we can manifest some of the egoism, the psychological egoism that we have. But we must do it within the paradigm of Islam. Now, the problems now, and we go back to consequentialism, is where do we... It's a conflict of interest. My rights, well, I do something, my wife's not going to like it. I'm not going to mention the examples. You know, but I think... Or I'm going to do something and my kids might... No, where is the... Okay, so this is how you make a decision. According to the Islamic paradigm, you make a decision based on the maslaha, ukhrawiyyah. What will produce the most benefit to this dunya and the hereafter? Now, you might not always know what that is. This is the problem. You don't know where that is. It's difficult. These are difficult decisions. You know? But that's where the fight is. That's where difficulty lies. Therein the difficulty lies. You know, you make a decision. What shall I do? Like, shall I do X? Shall I do Y? I want to enjoy myself, but I want to enjoy myself. You know why? So others can enjoy themselves. So I can relax. So at home everything's okay. So whatever, you know, I want to play football on a Friday night or a Saturday night, so that when I go home and I spend time with the kids, now I can give them quality time. No, you can't play football. Okay, well then watch what I'm going to be doing with the kids on Friday and Saturday. If you don't let the person have their own, or on the flip side, the wife, you know, I want to go to my friend's house. No, you can't go to your friend's house. All right, the one she's going to sit there and, you know, not like what she, you're not going to enjoy her time with you because she hasn't done what she wants to do. These are the kinds of, these are the practical, real life situations. But self-denial, there's two extremes. Perpetual self-denial, that's one extreme, which is not going to work. Like, psychologically, that's not going to work. Self-denial. I'm not going to go football. I'll sacrifice the family, sacrifice the family, sacrifice the family. Khalas, you're going to end up hating your family or resenting them. Even on an unconscious level, you're going to hate. You're going to start unconscious. You're going to start feeling like, why am I doing this? Why don't they get involved? Why? On the other hand is, where everything is that you want to live the single man's lifestyle, even though you're married and you've got kids and this, you don't want to pay money. For example, right? And that's an example of self-interest, which we don't analyze the consequences. So these are the kinds of things where we say, okay, well, let's bring the Sharia into it. Question, this is the question you need to all ask when you're making these decisions, and including me, and I'm saying this out loud because it helps me as well. What will suit the Islamic paradigm of most people being exposed to guidance? Qu anfusakum wa ahlikum nara. What's going to suit that? What's going to suit that? Is it going to be if I do X or if I do Y? What's going to lead to more of everyone going to heaven? For me, my family and everyone else. X or Y? That's where you have to play a game of careful game of probability. Careful game. Don't be clumsy. Like me. Make the wrong decisions and stuff. Prefrontal lobes have not developed yet. In the brain, and you start thinking, we start justifying our own BS kind of thing, you know. Sorry to say, and we think, you know, this. We would love the self-interested option to be the one that we need to do. Yeah. And sometimes it is, man. Sometimes it is the one, but we have to really ask ourselves this question: is this the best option that I have at the moment? And that's how the Sharia deals with it. The question you have to ask is different. What's going to lead to most guidance, most stability, most spirituality, most nearness to Allah for as many people as possible? Going back to the utilitarian model, but Islamic one. Greatest guidance for the greatest number. It's not greatest good for the greatest number. Greatest guidance for the greatest number. And with that, we conclude. And hopefully you've been able to understand what I've been trying. This is practical stuff today because a lot of it is psychological. Hopefully this helps us. This particular thing, I think, has clarified for me at least, you know, a lot of stuff in terms of how to make decisions in life. And that's what we need. But if you operate on an egoistic system, then your decisions are always going to have a conflict of interest with someone else. And that's one of the biggest problems of egoism. It's mentioned the matter actually, that my interest is going to go against her interest, his interest, And so actually me doing something against that person's interest and for my own interest is ironically against my own interest. You know, so we need to make the right decisions here. And we need to think about these things properly. And hopefully you've benefited from that. JazakAllahu khairan. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.